There's no place to escape to.
This is the last
podcast on the left.
From your glade.
That's when the cannibalism started.
I'd like to say, for one, as we start this show, I believe Robert Durst is innocent.
Why are you coming out in favor of Robert Durst?
I think he's cute and fun, and I think he's sweet, and I think he's got a bad rap.
You love him for the money, Henry. You want to pull an Anna Nicole Smith and marry that millionaire.
I'm just saying, if he gave me a chance, I could make the final years of his life in jail sweet years.
He's going to do so well in jail.
Every man has his reasons.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to put that as a sort of blanket term for all murder, but I think with Robert Durst in specific terms, he has had his reasons.
Mm.
Yes, he killed his wife.
He
absolutely killed his
just
wife.
Just because he didn't like her, though. But that's not a good reason to kill somebody.
It's a reason.
There's a reason for everything.
He killed that old man in cold blood. And fucking chopped up his body with a bone saw.
Yeah. He was old. He was in his 60s when he did that.
And that takes physical work.
Yeah.
That's hard.
50s.
Right? I'd say they should give him a medal for even being able to crack that guy's fucking spine in order to rip his head off. They're saying in order to rip his head off, he couldn't get the bone saw through his fucking neck bones.
How many times, huh?
You know, he had to step on the neck and literally wiggle the head back and forth until it came off the body.
Ah.
And that takes reasons.
That's good.
Robert Durst, a man of reasons.
It's good to treat your neighbor's head like a toddler's tooth. Just wiggle it out.
What I think is a good way to get a homeless man's head, a near homeless man's head, removed from his body is you tie a little string about it, tie it to a doorknob, slam the doorknob.
Well, all right, All right.
Am I paralyzed you with my Robert yes. Durst defense, please?
Yes. I mean, he made a bit of a mistake with the reality show.
Mm.
Usually when you're a triple murderer, you like to keep a little hush-hush.
You know?
But he started speaking while peeing, and that'll get anybody in trouble.
I can defense attorney that whole confession, but I won't do this here.
Good.
I believe that you can say he was sarcastically running out a conversation to himself.
Well, perhaps we'll cover Robert Durst and millionaire murderers on another episode.
But now we got a guy who's actually good at murder.
And he is poor as hell.
Of course,
it's part two of Mr. Edmund Kemper's story. We haven't really gotten to the gruesome dark stuff, but we're about to get into it now.
Now, this is, Let's really dig into this fucking huge loser. Huh? Again, back to talk about, like, Edmund Kemper. Largely, in my mind, the biggest sociopath murderer. Not even just physically. I think, like, in terms of deep sociopathy, he is up there.
He's a hell of a good bartender, and no one gives him credit for that.
Was he?
Yeah. Yep.
He was a bartender?
Yeah, that's what it was.
Huh? No.
He was working at a bar.
No, he wasn't. He just hung out at the bar.
He drank at a bar.
Well, I'm sure they let him behind the bar every now and again to sling suds.
Have you been telling bartenders that you're a bartender? So you can walk behind the
bar?
When you
walk into the bar, the waiter...
It's okay. Yeah. I'm a bartender.
I
know where all the gin is and know where all the vodka is, and I'll give you a tip. It's in my belly. Hey, my name's Ben.
Right. You walk in, you're the bartender... Then you get to drink everything.
We're getting into Edmund Kemper's first victims. We've now watched him. So he's rehearsed a lot up until this point, which I also think is a very big difference between him and other serial killers, is the straight up rehearsal time. It takes 10,000 hours to become an expert.
Practice, practice, practice. How do I get to prison in the future? Practice, practice, practice.
Yeah, he has been practicing for quite a while. And he does, if you'll remember, he does already have two murders under his belt. He has killed his grandparents at this point.
Grandparents don't count.
They do. They count for one. They definitely do, though.
So it's on May 7th, 1972, when he cannot resist the urge any longer. He picks up two college girls, Mary Ann Pesky and Anita Lucchesa. They're hitchhiking on a freeway ramp. He describes Mary as haughty, stuck up, not beautiful, not ugly, and distant.
Seems like he's lived in opposite town.
It does seem like that, because the last thing I think of a hitchhiker when I see them is, oh, they come from class. Look at that wealthy woman just hitchhiking like everyone should give her a ride for free.
But in this time period, it really was very true. Like, there was a lot of hitchhiking was very, very normal.
Yeah, but the Hiltons of the world weren't doing it. It was still a very middle-class mode of transportation.
Yeah, because it was Wilton Hilton, the 80-year-old progeny of the entire family who created the empire. He wasn't hitchhiking because he was riding slaves in 1972. He had a slave.
He did.
Yes, and he's hopped on his back for her. Mm. But this is, we're going to see, this is where the pattern emerges, where he views a woman who does not immediately engage with his nice guy personality, and he views her as stuck up, haughty, one of the bitches that his mom won't let him meet. Oh, mom! Mom! And all he wants to do is, rape.
Yeah. This girl, Marianne Pesky, she was an experienced hitchhiker. She didn't want to get in. Her red flags immediately went off because, for one, this is something, a little mistake that he made as far as picking up like doubles. He had a coupe. His Ford Galaxy didn't. You had to pull the seat back,
which is
in
a very
get in.
Creepy thing to do, because essentially you get in that back seat. If you can't get through the front seat, you're trapped in the car,
completely trapped. So Marianne didn't want to get in, but Anita, who was new to hitchhiking and thought, "Oh, this big man, he's fine," she convinced her to get in. And Ed also pulled the watch maneuver.
Watch, I got someplace to be. Oh, I'm sorry. I got to go to the giant shoe store. They're bringing in a shipment of leather to make me some new heels. I'm a performer.
So they were going to Stanford University. Ed, he knew the entire area very well from his time at the highway department. And so he started driving them around without them knowing that he had changed directions. He wasn't going to Stanford University. He was going to a remote location.
Classic maneuver.
Truly, though, that has got to be very frightening when he's saying that basically you're an hour into your trip. And you're like, where the hell are we going? Mm-hmm. And he's just like, eep. And he pulls that .22 out from underneath his seat.
Yep, he pulled a .22 caliber handgun from underneath the seat. He started by handcuffing Pesky into the back seat, and about what he told her, here's what he said.
I said, you know, I'm running the show here, or some cliche. There's absolutely no contact with improper areas. In fact, I think once I accidentally, this bothers me too, personally. I brushed, I think, with the back of my hand against one of her breasts when I touched it, and it embarrassed me. I even said, whoops, I'm sorry.
Whoops.
Yeah.
Classic. I mean,
this is what a fucking, but this is the deeper lie. You're now looking at when he starts, when these quotes all come from the confessions that he made, like literally either it was minutes up to after he was caught to like a couple of months.
Yeah.
And so these confessions were for his benefit. That is my perspective on him always.
I would just say, don't let him handcuff you. You know, just go with the no.
I mean,
start running.
He's got a 22 caliber handgun.
Get shot.
In your face.
Just get shot. I mean, you're gonna get shot with handcuffs on or without them.
Yeah,
so I would say go with a flail.
I am a squealing, twisting monster. If I ever get
make
him, you'll never catch me. Mm-hmm. I will just be like, and I won't stop till I'm dead.
The nightmares that person will remember, if they can just have the last memories being Henry squealing, flailing around, they'll never kill again.
Yep. This is, but he also talked about his move. The move he did to pull the .22, he said he would, because he had escalated over time, is that he would practice it, and he would keep the gun next to, underneath his leg, and he said he would sit in the car by himself and pretend, and basically practice pulling it, and pulling it,
it's
and pulling
fun.
It.
You got to.
It's like when you're a kid in the playground, and you count down 3, 2, 1, you take the shot and you make it, but he was doing that with a gun sitting in his car, and everyone's just like, why isn't this car moving? He's like, I'm practicing my gun work.
That's normal.
Yeah, I'm just doing my buzzer beater.
Okay.
So he takes Lucchesa out of the car after he handcuffs Pesky, and he locks her in the trunk. He comes back to Pesky.
And he does this as a part of, he believes that's showing sympathy.
Yes.
Because he says, he's like, well, I don't want her to see what I'm about to do to her friend.
It's the same thing that he did with it, that he used to justify killing his grandfather, is that he said that he didn't want his grandfather to see his wife's bullet-ridden corpse slumped over her children's
book. Little did he know his grandfather wanted to see that every single day he was alive.
If he opened up his journal journal even once, you would have seen he had sketched it a number of times.
Yeah, so he comes back to Pesky, who's still handcuffed in the back seat. He throws a plastic bag over her head because he said, "I had this nifty idea about suffocating."
Oh, that is pretty nifty.
Yeah, really
I'd say it's pretty keen.
Yeah, definitely.
So next, he wrapped a bathrobe belt around her neck. He pulled on the belt. The belt snapped, and Pesky bit through the bag. And I've got an interview clip, and this is what he said happens next.
I pulled a knife out. I still had the gun in my pants. I stabbed her. She didn't fall dead. You're supposed to fall dead. You're supposed to go, oh, and fall dead. I've seen it in all the movies, right? Doesn't work that way. When you stab someone, they leak to death. They lose blood pressure, and you stab them more and more and more. You complicate it many times by where you're hitting, the pain you're causing, and the aggravation of the person involved, plus whether or not they leak a little faster. It wasn't working worth the damn. I stabbed her all over her back, and she even turned around. I stabbed her in the side and the stomach once. Why? As she turned around, I could have stabbed her through the heart, but her breasts were there. And it actually deflected me. I couldn't see stabbing a young woman in her breast. That's embarrassing. I didn't say that to them back then, I don't think. I may have. But that's humiliating to admit that, that I was that affected by her presence. I stabbed her in the belly. That had to hurt worse. I didn't do it to make it hurt. I was trying to shut her up. And she ended up getting her throat cut. And I learned the term ear to ear, what that meant. Because that's the way it went.
Absolutely interesting. What a fucking piece of shit nerd. I think, like, it's a thing where it's just like, man, he just totally thinks that that reverence, like, makes up for it. He really does. And he does. And while he's even describing it, he's so distant from it. Saying the term, she ended up getting her throat cut, is like, she did it.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that's what he was saying, is that while that loving term, that loving thing when he's talking about her beauty and like wanting to stab her in the breast, up until then, he called her a straight-up, stone-cold, stuck-up bitch.
Yeah.
Leak is a strange word.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Spurt or drip or...
Leak is accurate. Yeah.
Yeah.
We're just bags of meat, Ben.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm well aware. I'm full of soft meat. So he just had this gun with him the whole time, and why didn't he just use that?
Because he forgot he had it. Yeah. Basically, you're going to find out later, he forgot he had it stuck in his pants, and he forgot to use it at
all.
Well,
when you're big, you can lose things on yourself.
I've seen you do it. I've seen you how many times you're like, "Hey, Henry, do I got shoes on?" And I'm just like, "Ben, how'd you get on the subway?"
Yeah, exactly.
So with Pesci bleeding out in the backseat, he basically goes over to kill the other,
Yeah, when he opens up the trunk, and Anita asks, said, "What happened to my friend?" Ed lied. He said, "I broke her nose because she wouldn't do what I wanted, so you need to come and help her." So Anita gets up, and Ed reaches into the trunk, and he brings out a knife called the original Buffalo Skinner, which he also called the General. Which is such a nerdy thing.
Fucking piece of shit.
Gotta go get the General.
Yeah, and he stabbed her in the throat, eyes, heart, and forearm. And he also said that he was surprised how many stab wounds it took before she lost consciousness.
He said she was wearing really thick overalls, and the knife wouldn't properly, like, literally bounced the first time he did it. And he said the first time he hit her so hard it threw her up onto the almost onto the roof of the car.
Yeah.
Right. And did he stab her boobs, or he didn't stab her boobs either? No boob stabs.
He's got a lot of reverence for the boobs, if you haven't noticed by now.
Yeah, which just sounds like a dude with a fucking Xbox headset and going like, the boobies are just so pink.
And he said about the knife, it was very expensive, about $8 or $9.
That is expensive.
Wow, an $8 or $9 knife, you say?
In 1972 money, that had to have been $19, $20.
This cup of coffee was $3. Wow. And I can't even kill a co-ed with this cup of coffee.
Did you know for just triple the price, you could get a knife that could skin a woman?
What?
Yes.
So he drove back home towards Alameda, and like a lot of other guys, he got stopped by a police officer. He was stopped for a broken taillight. Classic. But of course, he knew exactly how to talk to cops. And Kemper said during the entire interview, he was excited, and he had the officer, he said that had the officer decided to just do a routine check and look into the trunk where the two bodies were, Kemper would have shot the cop in the back of the head. Would have just killed him on the spot.
Because that's what he was. A big detail, too, about that first crime is that when he stabbed her and he put the bodies in the trunk and he closed the trunk for the first time, he panicked because he couldn't find his keys.
Yeah.
And he was saying that he he's like, oh my God, I've lost my keys in the back of the car. Like, I'm fucked. And he ran. He was like, I'm going to run. And that's how he realized he had forgotten about the gun, is that the gun had fallen down inside of his pants. And he tripped over the gun like a fucking huge bumble butt. And he tripped over the gun.
He was a bumble butt.
And then had to go back, and he was just like, all right, Ed. Check every one of your pockets. He's like, all right, okay, no, this is right, this is a chicken wing.
Can't start a car with that.
This is a big fun, paper cowboy hat. Where I get that? Oh, I must have got that over at Suds. Here's my keys.
Here it is. He was going to shoot himself in the leg with that gun like Plaxico Burress, it sounds like. It was just in his pants. He's got to stop wearing stretch pants or sweatpants to the murders.
Stop being so casual.
Indeed.
So he gets home, carries the corpses into his apartment, which, by the way, he is sharing with a friend of his
at this point. What does your roommate do exactly?
It seems like he does a lot of, it seems to be amateur surgery, but otherwise, he's a fun guy, cool guy, hangs out with cops, cool guy.
Yeah.
Yep, he takes him inside, he dissects the bodies. By the way, his roommate was out of the apartment that night.
Good.
Yeah. He had curling practice.
Yep. Eddie, I'm going to curling practice. I won't be back for 5 hours, so if you do happen to kill two co-eds, you want to skin him in the living room, tonight's the night to do it. Okay, bye.
Cool. I didn't even think about doing that.
The roommate's to blame for all of this.
Yep. He dissected the bodies, snapped some Polaroids, cut the heads off, and then had sex with the various parts of what remained.
And talk about a guy who really jumped right deep into the cycle of the killer.
My God.
And this is the other thing, too, is that, I think, to be honest, if I were to dismember a woman, I would remove the head last. Because what I admire most about a woman is her personality.
Well, it's all in the head.
But she's dead. No, but she's...
Yeah, but there's some kind of block in my mind of like how could she be talking to me and joking around with me if her head's not attached to her body?
Well, Ed Kemper, about that exact point, he said, with a girl, there's a lot left in the girl's body without the head. Of course, the personality is gone.
Yeah, that's one of the things about murdering a woman. You lose all of her charms.
It's all the conversation you miss.
Right.
About the heads, he said, I remember there was actually a sexual thrill. You hear that little pop and pull their heads off and hold their heads up in the air, whipping their heads off, body just sitting there.
Mm-hmm.
That'd get me off.
Yeah, that's it. When you're just about to come there and the head pops right off, Jaddy?
I just shoot even worse.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? And I got to tell you, and I'm a Marilyn Monroe guy. I like a girl with a normal figure.
Love her.
So he keeps the heads for a little while. On one occasion, he said that he was just sitting there staring at one of the heads that he had rested on the chair across from him. The head became unsettled somehow. It rolled off the chair. And a human head, by the way, weighs about as much as a bowling ball.
Seven, 8 pounds?
Yeah, 7, 8 pounds. Hits the ground with a huge thud. And Ed said,
the neighbor downstairs hates my guts. I'm always making noise late at night. He gets a broom and whacks on the ceiling. Buddy, I say, I'm sorry for that. Drop my head. Sorry. That helped bring me out of the depression.
And that's the bravest, luckiest neighbor of all time.
You see, I feel like even in New York specifically, even if the neighbors knew you were dismembering a body, they would still be like, keep it down!
Oh, yeah, I'd still bring the broom out.
I gotta drive a train at 6 o'clock in the morning. You gotta tell me, hey, listen, you're gonna be decapitating bitches up in your apartment when I gotta ask you to do. I don't mean to step on your business, buddy. All right, what I'm gonna ask you to do, put down a couple blankets.
I might just turn up the Netflix. I might let the whole thing go. I don't know.
So after he's done with the bodies, he puts the remains into plastic bags and buries them in the Santa Cruz Hills, torso and limbs in one location, hands in a second, and he disguised the burial grounds with techniques he learned from the Boy Scouts, the same place he learned how to use the Buffalo Skinner General.
The Boy Scouts teach you how to be a Nazi, and they also teach you how to kill women.
It's a bad organization.
Yeah. And it's because they won't let gay kids in there.
I've heard that.
If there was gay kids in there, there'd be a fashion design badge, and they'd be wearing nice clothes.
Well, it's a little stereotypical there.
But. Well, there'd also be a fucking sous chef badge where they would learn how to make fancy sauces.
Oh, okay. Well, now I might join now, yeah.
So the heads he kept for a few more days, orally copulating with them before
That is a very nice way of saying face fucking.
You know what? I tried to be as sensitive as I possibly could with that one.
You know, because that's what he would even say. He would call it humiliating the corpse.
Yeah.
He specifically viewed that as a humiliation technique.
Yeah.
And also, it's just a... You just get sick of masturbating. I know I'm single. I've lived in a hotel for a long time.
Sure.
You know, I mean, I'm not really at the point where I'm going to sever a human head and use it as a fleshlight, but that's mostly just because I like freedom and I don't want to...
Yeah.
It's just, so much effort.
It's just weird when your to-do list is like, get the hitchhikers, kill them, put them in a baggie, disrespect the corpse, check. That's just a bizarre day.
Yeah.
Get milk and eggs. Don't forget the eggs.
So after he orally copulated with the heads, he just chucked them into a ravine.
Yeah,
the girls were reported missing, but because, as Henry said earlier, hitchhiking was such a, people were just very transient then.
Right.
Hitchhiking was a big thing. People would disappear for weeks at a time. So when these girls were reported missing, police didn't really do anything. And they didn't find Pesky's head until 9 days later. Anita, they haven't found her remains at all to this day.
Yeah, that's for the best, you know.
God, probably. Good Lord. Yeah. You know what also is, you know, a fleshlight can go in the dishwasher.
Yeah, well.
Nah, you don't need to put it in the dishwasher.
You know?
No, you just
kind of. You do! We're not talking about your fleshlight, Marcus. It is so disgusting and disturbing.
Had it for about 5 years now. Still going strong.
Wow, right. You see, it hasn't lost any of its tautness?
Absolutely not. They're very well made.
Wow.
It is disgusting.
So now we basically see this is. Kemper's style has been completely set. It is just like right out of the gate, which is really interesting because normally killers build to this, but it feels like his rehearsal and his fantasy life was so deep and intense. It's like he knew exactly what he wanted.
It's like Russell Wilson. He won the Super Bowl when he was a rookie. He thought about it. He thought about it. He got there and he did it.
You know what? It is a lot like that.
It is.
Yeah. And he said he characterized it as making dolls out of people because they couldn't they couldn't reject them. You know, so that was as after he cut off the heads, there was no rejection whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean, you got to sell them if you're going to make them.
And although he later recanted and said that this statement was only meant for his insanity defense, on at least two occasions, he cannibalized his victims, slicing flesh from their legs and cooking it in a macaroni casserole.
Oh, isn't that kind of a nice place to put human flesh?
The Midwest, such a... No. Yeah, it's really strange that it's a California casserole, because they're not really known for their casserole.
No, that's why everyone loved having Ed over for potlucks, because he brought that Wisconsin flair, even though he was from California. How do you know?
Well, he grew up in Montana.
Oh, there we go.
Oh, that's very nice. Casserole country.
Montana is casserole. Oh, I love casseroles.
But I will say this, is that we see a lot with killers, too, who dabble in cannibalism, because I don't view him as a cannibalistic killer. I just think that when your perversions are so intense, and you're dealing with a lot of shit, you kind of look at something and be like, I'm going to eat a little bit.
Try a little bit. But he did eat it.
He's
a cannibal.
I mean, technically he's a cannibal.
Right, I mean, that's all that we can run on here.
But I wouldn't call him a cannibal. Would you call Michael Jordan a baseball player?
Technically he was.
Technically, but you don't think of him like that.
Look at percentage of career.
Right.
All right, if the majority of his career was spent looking for people to eat,
He's not going into the Hall of Fame for baseball, but he's going in for basketball. But I'm just saying he did play baseball.
I get it. I mean, I think we're in agreement here.
Okay. I'm just going to say it.
It's on his resume, but it's not the top of the resume. Okay.
I'm just saying you kill and cook someone, put them into a casserole, you're a cannibal.
Yeah, it's under skills. It's like how you would probably list Microsoft Word under your skills,
or
right?
Parasailing. Yeah. I lie. I usually lie on that part.
Canadabbler.
Yes.
So all of his victims were chosen randomly on the spot. This wasn't a planned thing where he would plan out victims, and almost all of his murders from here on out would occur after fights with his mother. He'd have a knockdown, drag-out fight with his mother. Mm. He'd get extremely angry, and he'd say, like, all right, I'm going out. Tonight's the night that I'm going to fucking do it.
He said his rage is what really drove him. And he said he would go on these rages where he was just like, you know, anybody who got in my car was going to die that night.
Yeah, he said when someone put their hand on my car door handle, they were giving me their life. Hmm. Because after he killed these first two girls, he went back to just picking them up. and taking them safely to their destination.
Because that's also a distancing thing, too. Because originally he said the behavior was just for him to learn how to talk to girls. So he went back to it and be like, well, I can actually do this again. Now that I got, now I'll have a bit cooling off period. I can talk to women again and just kind of work it up. And he said that what he would do is they would get in the car and the first thing they'd all talk about is the guy who killed those hitchhikers. Mm-hmm. And then he would be like, what do you think a guy like that would be like? And they would be like, oh, you know, and they would describe somebody and then he would start to learn how to even deeply mold his persona.
Yeah.
So then that's why he started wearing the blonde wigs and wearing the fake mustaches or...
Yeah, and saying like, Dolly Parton!
Lover. That had to be a very fun conversation for him to have with those people about the killer. The same reason he talked to the cops about it.
But he
you
said,
get your God complex out because they know less than you do. He was wearing the Google glasses talking with somebody who had no information at all.
But he definitely said that if they brought up the killer at all, they were definitely safe because he was too embarrassed to then kill them.
Good note. So if you get into a car, just so what about that killer, huh? He's picking up everybody? Just no matter where you go, no matter what you do, you never know when you're with the presence of madness.
Yeah, I mean, that's just kind of my practice anyway. Start talking to a stranger, just immediately start jabbering about killers.
That's what I always do.
Yeah, that's what I always do. I mean, it's a compulsion, rather, and I don't really, and I'm uncomfortable, and I don't know what else to talk about. I'm
because that's all I think about is killers.
That's all I think about,
and how reality's a thin fucking veil and we live in a hologram of a deeper math, and it's harder to talk about that with someone you just met.
Let's just go around the table real quick. Successful dates in the last month. Successful dates in the last month. I got none.
Last night, okay. I had about 3 glasses of scotch and I watched The Wire for 2 hours.
Not a date.
Oh, that's not?
Nah. No, another person. Okay.
It's a date with Henry.
I got lucky.
I got real lucky.
Okay, no.
So he kept that whole charade of picking up girls and just taking them to their destination for 4 months until September 14th, 1972. Me and Henry were talking about this before, and this is probably the saddest victim.
This really makes
all
me very sad.
All these victims are very sad. Like, they're all extremely sad because these are among the saddest victims because these are, you know, I mean, not to say that, you know, other victims are worth less or anything because we always talk about the less dead and all this, but these are, you know, just truly innocent victims.
Yeah, like, I mean, at least if Gacy killed you, you got to hang out with an up-and-coming Democratic politician or future congressman.
You were drinking and doing drugs. Right. It's kind of like the Jason, you know, the Friday the 13th Nightmare on Elm Street type thing of being like, well, maybe you should have been naughty and you wouldn't have been buried in the crawl space.
Right.
Not to victim blame.
Ted Bundy's an adorable kind of a dreamboat guy. Jeffrey Dahmer definitely got you wasted.
Damn.
Before he started trying to drill in your head.
But Aiko
this
Koo,
guy's just a monster.
Aiko Koo is a very sweet girl that I guess that was his next victim that he picked up. It was a 15-year-old ballet dancer.
Yeah, she was hitchhiking. She was going to San Francisco for a ballet class. She missed her bus. Really wanted to make that class, so she made a sign that said San Francisco. So he picks her up, and he doesn't even wait until he gets to a secluded spot. This must have been a horrible fight with his mother, because he pulls out the gun while they're still on the road.
It was probably about how he farted on the no-fart couch.
Yeah, I mean, you know.
Yeah, he pulls out the gun, and he told her that he was planning on killing himself, and he wanted someone to watch it, but he told her that if she screamed or signaled to anyone at all that something was wrong, he would kill her as well. And this is a very interesting thing. At one point, he gets out of the car and accidentally locks himself out with the gun inside the car.
Oh, that is goofy.
Yeah, he said she could have reached over and grabbed the gun at all, but he said she probably never gave it a thought. She was so terrified because she was a tiny little 15-year-old girl.
Absolutely. And he's a giant monster.
A 6'9", 300-pound monster.
Who is now locked out of the car. Get the gun!
Yeah, no, she lets him back in.
No. Ah. You know,
yeah.
She's no Sigourney Weaver.
Well, you just got to get the gun. Use the gun.
So he drives her out to the mountains, only minutes from the house of one of the case investigators.
That's one of those things about Los Angeles and California in specific. It's like basically it's got tiny little houses surrounded by these mountains. And you basically go up into those mountains and you disappear.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you really do. So he tries to suffocate her first by placing his fingers up her nostrils. But I mean, she was able to fight him off.
Right.
But eventually he strangled her with her own scarf. And after she was dead, He laid her on the ground, raped her, and said he achieved orgasm within seconds.
Right, so it was sort of Three Stooges-ish, you know, getting locked out of the car, then with the fingers in the nose, but then it got real, then it got a little
That's the thing, it goes straight from Three Stooges to that Spanish movie Irreversible.
Yeah. It really does. So after he kills her, he places the body in the trunk and drives her home, but not before stopping for a beer. He goes inside of the bar. He has a couple of beers. He walks back into the parking lot and opens the trunk, admiring my catch like a fisherman.
This term, admiring my catch like a fisherman, is another thing of just like what a deeply, deeply distanced man he is from himself.
Yeah, disconnected from everything, disconnected from the world at large. So he takes the corpse back to his apartment, cuts off the head and hands, and has sex with the corpse. The next morning, he buries the body in one location, the hands at another, and with her head in a bag, drives to his court-mandated psychiatrist appointment.
So how are things going, Ed? You know?
Things are pretty good. I think I'm getting ahead in my career.
And, well, I mean, I can tell you exactly what the psychiatrist thought of him that day. The report said from the first second, he saw two psychiatrists that day. The report said, if I were seeing this appointment without having any history available or without getting the history from him, I would think that we're dealing with a very well-adjusted young man who had initiative, intelligence, and who was free of any psychiatric illness.
Bullshit!
It is my opinion that he has made a very excellent response to the years of treatment and rehabilitation, and I would see no psychiatric reason to consider him to be any danger to himself or to any member of society.
It's almost like your medical field is flawed and you shouldn't technically be called a doctor.
And the second appointment actually used the words normal and safe. Both recommended the sealing of his juvenile records as a way to help him become a better citizen. Thus, 8 years after he had killed his grandparents, Kemper gained his complete and total freedom.
Yes. If you are a psychiatrist, just at the end of every single paper, just dot, 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 also might be a killer.
Might be a
killer,
I'm not really sure.
Maybe not.
And let's play what actually was going on the interior of Edmund Kemper's mind during these psychiatrist sessions.
To be walking up the stairs with a camera bag that belonged to a young woman that had her severed head in it. Walking up to my apartment past a happy young couple coming down the stairs who nodded and smiled at me as they went by. Good evening. And they're going out on a date where I'd love to be going. And I'm aware of both of these realities, and the distance between those two is so dramatic, so amazing, so violent, that really, I could feel the wheels squeaking inside. That was really pulling on it. And I imagine at that point some people break. But I didn't literally go insane. I didn't get lost.
And all this time.
Yeah, he was doing totally good.
Totally. I did not go crazy, though. I mean, he could have just had a date with one of these women at the same time. You just don't kill him, and then you might maybe get to ask him out afterwards.
I mean, the thing is that if you don't have much past, like, hitchhiker patter, right, you're not going to do well on dates. Yeah, you know what I mean? Because the conversation between pickup and hitchhiker are not, like, we're not talking about, like, great shit. I mean, I don't know. I've never hitchhiked. Maybe you get into nice, like, cool, interesting conversations with people.
I think it must be a little bit awkward up top, but then you gotta find a way. I'm sure that he had a sentence that he said to all of these people in the very beginning.
You got pretty hair. I wonder what it's like laying on the ground, you know, separate from the rest of your body. Well, it's going to rain here soon.
What I would also say about him is that also that statement to me shows how deeply nuts he was.
Oh,
and I mean, in terms of sociopath, because I feel like there's more of a deviousness to it when he talks about how, like, he could have went insane, but he was too strong to go insane. That what he did, you know, like he could face it.
Oh, he sees himself as the hero in this story.
Yeah,
he sees himself as a hero because he didn't kill anymore, because he turned himself in. I don't know the reason why, but after he kills Eiko Ku, he moves back in with his mother.
Hey, you know, you know when they say, like, certain songs would, like, come out of one specific guitar?
Yeah.
Even if it's an old shitty guitar.
Oh, yeah, you know, like Trigger, like Willie Nelson's guitar. Yeah. It's a great guitar, but yeah, it's the guitar that all of his best songs
songs are written on? Yeah. You gotta get back to the source.
I'm gonna say Trigger is a bit of a It's a touchy word for Willie to be yelling across a bar. Yeah. No, give me my trigger. Excuse me? What was that, Willie? What? No, it's the guitar.
Yeah. It's the one with the rope around its neck. Well, I mean strap.
Okay.
Okay. Well, how's about Lucille?
I like Lucille. That's a all name right. that can't be, you know, yeah, become yeah, a yeah. racial slur immediately.
Well, trigger is more, it's more the name of a horse, but we'll,
yeah. okay,
that's a different story. So Kemper didn't kill again until he bought a .22 caliber pistol in January. And he said,
I went bananas after I got that .22.
Bananas?
Bananas!
Wow.
Positively conkers.
That's amazing. I love it. He just treats it like a game of Candy Crush. It is. That's insane.
So the same day he bought the gun on January 8th, 1973, he picked up Cynthia Shawl, who made a habit of hitching rides to Cabrillo College. He brings out the gun again while he's driving. He drives her to a town called Freedom.
Ironic.
Very ironic. Yikes. And stopped on a quiet road. He shoots her, dumps her body in the trunk, and took her home. She was a big girl, so Ed struggled to get her upstairs. His mother came home right as Ed was stuffing her into the closet, and he just talked to his mom normally.
Ed, what are you doing? You want to get chicken, Ed? Ed, you want to go get some chicken? What are you doing in there, Ed? You jerking off?
Yeah.
You pervert! You disgusting pervert, Ed!
Now I just can't stop thinking of Throw Mama from the Train.
Yeah.
The mother from the Goonies, the greatest bad mother of all time.
Mom, I'm hanging out with a friend. Mom, I'm having a good time with my friend.
Oh, my goodness.
He returned to the room, and he carefully removed the bullet from her skull. And he does this again and again. When he shoots the person in the head, he always removes the bullet from the skull first. All business.
Because he's also he's a student.
Yeah.
And he understands, he's been hanging out with comps all the time, and he fancies himself a fucking little genius.
Right, right.
That he's like, I know how to get rid of all of the evidence.
Yeah, but on the other hand, he does.
Yes.
If he wouldn't have turned himself in, I don't think they would have caught him until he would have gone into a berserker.
Well, we'll talk about it when we get there, but he definitely, no one, they did not know. They had no clue who the killer was.
Yeah, no idea. So the next day, he brought the corpse back out, had sex with it before dissecting the body in the shower with an axe.
Uh-oh.
Yeah! Yeah!
So how big of a gal are we talking here?
I mean, I don't have the exact dimensions.
But she was just larger.
I mean,
she was just larger than the others.
Yeah, okay. Because he usually went for petite women.
That was
kind of his type. But for some reason, Cynthia Shawl just, you know, she had a twinkle in her eye, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
So after he drained the body of all of her blood, he carved it into pieces, bagged up all the pieces, and threw him off the cliff. He had sex with the head for several days before burying it in the yard.
Now, this is a very interesting detail.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
He buried the head right outside of his window in the ground and facing towards the house, and he said that he would have as a sort of boyfriend-girlfriend-like relationship with the image of her head, where he would sit in bed and talk to her at night, and they would have like a thing back and forth. And there was also, but then there's another theory that he said that he buried it in the head to mock his mother.
Yeah, because he said that his mother always wanted people to look up to her.
That's funny stuff.
It's fun little puns like right. that make him the charmer we know him to be.
I love it. It's sort of like a Jack and the Beanstalk, but instead of beans, it's a human head, and instead of a giant, he's finding love, which is kind
of
nice.
Well, both of those stories come from him. Because as we said at the beginning of the first episode, his story changes depending on who he's talking to.
Yes, and what kind of effect he wants to get.
Yeah, what kind of effect he wants. And I think he's also good at reading people. So he
obviously
can tell. Yeah, I think he knows what the person wants to hear. He has a narrative. He has a story that he tells each time. It's the same story, just with different details.
He straight up has like Tonight Show bits.
Yeah.
And they talk about it because there's another quote that we have later on. But are we going to play where basically a guy interrupts him in the middle of his story, and he's like, wait, you're going to ruin the bit there.
Yeah.
And it's like this. He literally says it because it's rehearsed patter.
Yeah.
It really is. He has a rhythm. He knows exactly. I mean,
he has no idea how to be a real person.
No, he doesn't.
He's a total robot. That is like, he's a sociopath. Every single thing he does is highly rehearsed and highly put together because he has no real personality. It is just a combo of factors that he has like put together. He really was. It's like this is a truly dangerous man.
Yeah.
That needed to be put in.
Well, we already all know that.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, he's on his like eighth head now or something.
So less than 2 days later, dismembered arms and legs were found on a cliff overlooking the Pacific Ocean. Then
you gotta get him into the water, buddy.
He didn't throw it far
enough.
Come
on, get him into the water.
Here's the funny thing is that he was able to make the torso into the water,
sure,
but the arms and legs didn't make it. I guess he was winded from the torso.
I guess so.
Those are, you know, sometimes big guys got that natural hook.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So they identified Shawl through lung x-rays. Eventually, the lower torso came in. A surfer also found her left hand, which offered fingerprints, but her right hand never washed up.
Mm.
The media, at this point, in a huge panic, because not only, if we remember correctly, Ed Kemper was not the only killer in Santa Cruz, California at this time. There was also Herbert Mullen, who had racked up 13 in a big spree.
Murder capital of the world.
Yeah, murder capital of the world. One reporter, her name was Marilyn Baker. She was a big tabloid lady. She consistently exaggerated rumors and offered uncorroborated information as fact. She gave daily reports of course, blamed it on satanic rituals.
Mm-hmm. Well, now everybody, it's a great scapegoat.
Yeah.
And it makes great news.
Yeah. And she's saying shit like she suggested that the killer was a lesbian or a transvestite.
Ooh.
She started putting in these weird details that all the murders occurred on Mondays after dark and during a full moon.
That's just kind of fun.
Because also what it does,
it is fun.
It's
yeah.
cool
super
as shit.
Fun. Yeah,
but it's also a way to differentiate the crimes. It also makes you, again, it's the idea of putting order to it.
Yeah.
Instead of it just being some random man that they can't find, they're basically saying it's a part of an established magic group. Now that everybody is doing hippy-dippy bullshit and wearing lanyards all the time,
well,
they think that they can blame it all on that.
They've got to go find that lesbian satanic group that is also transgendered, God, and then boom, you've got your killer.
Just let me in the room with them. That sounds amazing.
Yeah.
I want to be in a lesbian satanic coven.
No.
Ooh, I'll be fun for it.
Yeah,
I'll be the chef.
Maybe if you're the chef, but yeah, I think you're supposed to take it a little more seriously.
So many girls going missing. Of course, there were constant warnings for them to not get into cars with strangers,
mm-hmm.
but Ed had a secret weapon because the university had decided to institute a bus system that would assist off-campus students getting safely to campus.
And it was a sticker.
Ed had a sticker that his mother had given him, a university-issued sticker, so he could easily get into campus and pick her up from work.
Yeah, because that's what they said, that they were like, nobody get into a car that doesn't have a sticker.
Yeah.
And so he had a big sticker that had a letter A on it, which meant he had all access to the entire campus.
Yeah. And he said,
amazing that all it takes is a 25-cent, probably a 10-cent sticker at this time to make everyone just give you full 100% trust.
Yeah. And his next victims, he used that sticker to his advantage. February 5th, 1973, had a violent fight with his mother. Ed called it a real tiff. And drove to campus. Actually drove on campus where his mother worked.
If we're going to have a fart couch and a no fart couch, mm-hmm. then they need to not be next to each other.
That's true, because when you got a fart, yeah, you just want to do it right there on the couch.
He picks up Rosalind Thorpe, who was just coming out of a lecture, and then picked up 21-year-old Alice Liu. He shot both of them in the head while they were still on university grounds. Hmm. And in one account, Kemper said that two young men were at a security gate, but when they saw Kemper's university sticker, they just waved him right on through. And in another account, Kemper said that he told the guards that the girls were just drunk and he was just trying to get them home.
Of course.
Of course.
It was 3 p.m. on whatever day it was.
Yeah, two women literally lumped over in the front and back seat of your car. Oh, yeah, yep. Nothing suspicious.
I would say both of those women are dead, but you do make a good point. You do have that sticker.
And you got the sticker.
You have the sticker. I got to let you go through.
Yeah, Kemper said it was getting easier to do and I was getting better at it. He took the bodies home, but as his mother was home, he had to wait until he can take him inside. But what he couldn't wait on was dismembering the bodies, he took his hunting knife, the general, and hacked off both of their heads while they were still in the trunk of his car in full view of neighbors. If someone would have walked by, Jesus, they would have seen this fucking monster hacking the heads off of two young co-eds.
Legitimately, car parked outside of his mother's house on the street.
Right.
It's not even covered. It's nothing. He was getting... He really... Again, this is, it shows his ego.
Yeah.
He really is, at this point, thinks that he can get away with anything.
Yeah. So he placed both of the bodies back in the trunk. He cut off Alice's hands, then dumped the bodies and heads in two separate places where they were found 9 days later. These two girls would be Ed's last co-ed victims.
Yep.
I mean, the one thing that you have to remember, like when smoking weed in public, just do it. Pretend like you're like Johnny Depp, to use him as a reference again in the movie Blow. The most important thing to do when carrying whatever pounds of cocaine through an airport is to pretend like you're not doing it. If you're cutting off a person's head, just pretend like you're changing a tire.
Well, like Johnny Depp and Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, where you just kind of forget that you're in a movie.
He stops acting?
Yeah.
Oh, I love the real Chocolate Factory.
Yeah, and your natural pedophilic impulses just kind of come out.
Just
on screen.
I love that.
So yes, these were his last two victims. Mm-hmm. So now we're looking
at last two co-ed victims.
Right. We're looking at a man who's like built all the way up to this sort of fever pitch in his own head. And he was saying he was really trying very hard to quell it for a while.
Did he really try though?
More than not, I feel like more than not doing it altogether. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah, he did make a conscious effort to not do it. And the fact that he turned himself in does tell you that he was actually trying to do it. But pretty soon after he killed these two girls, a police officer, he was checking through gun licenses.
And the way they found this, too, is very interesting.
Yeah.
Is that this, so his record was expunged for killing his grandparents. And so they were going through, and they were going through driver's licenses, because basically there's like a random sweep where they go through a bunch of gun license things, like forms and shit, and make sure everything's up to date and everything's up to par. And they were going through and they're like, oh, Eddie Kemper. Oh, yeah, that big fucking the Bumble Butters was hanging out and being annoying.
I remember
I was like, it says here, it's like, what is this thing? And they noticed that back in the day, instead of issuing a new card, they literally would just cross out your record on the card.
They'd black it out, kind of like, redacted on classified forms.
But it was like
forms.
With a marker.
Yeah.
And so he's like, what does it say underneath this thing? And he looks at it, and basically he sees through the marker that he was put into an insane asylum for killing his grandparents. And he's just like, you guys know that Eddie Kemper murdered somebody? And they're like, no. And he's like, yeah, he killed his fucking grandparents. And they're like, what gun does he have? And he's like, he's got a massive .45.
Yeah.
And so they're like, we got to go get him. We got to go get this gun. And they all knew him. And so they're like, well, this guy's 6'9" and 300 pounds. Who wants to go get the gun from him?
Right, and you know, if he throws you over the top rope, you're out.
You're out.
So you can't come back into the investigation.
Yeah.
So
they sent the rookie.
They sent a guy. They literally drew straws, and the rookie lost. And the rookie is literally this literally tiny guy. I saw an interview with him, and he's like, so I just, I knew that, so it was up to me. Go roll up Eddie. So I rolled on over to the car, and they were saying they have a hard time finding the address. And they went over to the car. Basically, he went around looking. It was like one of those things where it was like 609A, 609B. There was a bunch of different houses all in a cul-de-sac, and he couldn't see anybody. And he was looking around, and finally he said, I saw a pair of feet hanging out of the car. And he walks up to him, he's like, excuse me, sir, is that, can you point me towards a 609A? And he was like, and then I watched Ed Kemper get out and get out and get out of the car. Because he was like, it's just all of his body coming pour out of this car, and him standing all the way up. And he was like, can I get your gun back?
This guy approaches Kemper like Wayne, or like Garth did in Wayne's World when he confronted the bully with the
excuse me.
I'd like to get by now.
But he said then he went into it. So then Eddie, then in his mind, starts going paranoid. He's like, what gun do they want?
Yeah.
Because he's like, I got a .45 in my house, but I also have a shit ton of other fucking illegal guns in my house.
I've also got that .22 that I've been killing all these girls with
inside of my car.
Yeah.
And so finally, when he said the .45, he's like, oh, yeah. Yeah.
God, that's got to be just such a strange thought process of, hoping they don't know the right gun.
Yeah, it really is. So there was also a young blonde girl there with Ed. And if the cop hadn't come, he would have killed that girl.
Yeah.
So right. he just let the girl go. And 2 months after he killed those two girls, I'd say he was started to play what I could only describe as Russian roulette with other people's lives. He just started picking up girls just to test himself, just to see if he could pick girls up and not kill them.
Right.
But here's like some ridiculous irony. There was two girls that he picked up. That he
looked exactly the same as yes. Marianne, as the first two
yes,
victims.
The first two. They wanted him to take them the wrong way to their destination, which would have taken them straight to the site of the first two murders. But Ed knew the right way. He's like, no, you don't go this way. We have to go this way. And that's the amazing irony, is that he scared those two girls more than he scared any of his victims.
Absolutely, because they were freaking out, because he was just like, no, let me take you the right way. Let me take you the right way.
Yeah.
And he did it, and then he dropped them off. But it was this point. So that mounting pressure from inside his own brain to kill.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, with the cops buzzing him for that gun,
has
started firing up his paranoia.
He thought that the cops were playing a cat and mouse game with them.
Yeah, they were just stupid.
Yeah, it was just complete coincidence. So after that, he spends an entire week thinking about, okay, it's time.
I am going to go to the Delta of my crimes, and it's time to kill mommy.
And he would go through it that Sunday, Easter weekend.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I think it was a part of him. I thought that maybe if I kill her, she'll come right back. Huh?
Yep, you never know who's going to rise on Easter.
So he walks into her room on Saturday night while she's reading. She slams her book shut and she said,
"Oh my God, now I suppose you want to stay up all night and talk."
She was a cold woman.
She was a very cold woman. Because that was the thing, is that he was such a fucking huge, dorky fucking mama's boy that he would go and sit on the corner of her bed every night and like tell him about his problems and his feelings, and she hated him for it.
Yeah.
He was just a gigantic nuisance.
Yeah.
Right.
And he said he just goes, "Nope," and left the room and returned 4 hours later with a claw hammer.
And what's also very interesting, in one of his first interviews, he breaks into tears talking about this, because he says he was psyching himself up all night. And you see, because every other victim he talks about with sort of a smugness, sort of like a thing above him.
I pulled one over on them.
Yeah. Or they deserved it, blah, blah, blah. And then that thing we said, it's not that I did a horrible thing, but it's a horrible thing happened to them.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And so he was, of course, very conflicted about killing his mother, but he knew he had to do it.
Into the window and you look at your own reflection and you're like Annette Bening in American Beauty and you're like, I will sell this house tonight. I will murder my mother today. I will do it.
So he bashes her head in as she slept.
He
rolls her over, slits her throat, and he said that he was shocked at how easy it was to kill her, that she died just as easily as all the rest of them.
Oh, an elderly sleeping woman? That wasn't the most difficult kill you've ever had?
To be honest, this part, I imagine he thought she was like fucking King Koopa when he'd come back black and white and start like, you know, like changing, like flashing red.
I
wonder what he thought was going to happen when he did like stab it, like light was going to come from her or something.
I don't know.
She was going to turn into a stronger demon force, like in
like at the end of Ocarina of Time when you think you've beaten Ganondorf, and then the tower blows up, then you got to deal with super big Ganondorf.
Ganondorf, more like Momondorf.
Pretty much. Yeah, dead alive, I was thinking as well.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. So he then decided that, quote, what's good enough for my victims was good enough for my mother.
Oh, very nice of you, Ed.
It wasn't very nice.
No.
He cuts off her head, has sex with her corpse. He goes a little bit further. He removes her vocal cords and throws them in the garbage disposal.
But they won't grind up because they're too thick.
Yeah, they keep popping back out of the garbage disposal into his face.
And it's like, it seemed appropriate as much as she bitched and screamed and yelled at me so much over the years. Even when she was dead, she was still bitching at me. Couldn't get her to shut up.
I wonder if when he was having sex with his mother's head, you know, if he was just like, I think this is a career defining moment.
You know what?
I think this is how people are going to define my entire life.
This is my Saving Private Ryan.
This is great.
So he spends the next few hours yelling and screaming at his mother's head. He places the head up on the mantle, yells and screams at the head, and then just starts throwing darts at her face.
He was upset.
He was upset.
I know. I blow off steam. I've yelled at the coffee maker.
Yeah, I mean, you know,
in these last couple of months, I've yelled at some stuff in my house that doesn't need to be yelled at. You know, I held my TV like it was a woman once.
No, we don't talk about that. We don't talk about that. Yeah. This has been recorded, Henry.
So he felt sick. He goes out for a drive. He sees an acquaintance who owes him $10, and they went out for a drive in his friend's car, and he's still got the urge to kill. Like, he is fucking keyed up.
He said his buddy gave him the $10 and it saved his friend's fucking life.
Oh, that's nice.
God damn.
So if you owe a buddy a debt, just pay up right now.
Seriously, shut off this podcast. Go to your buddy's house and pay him right now.
Right. Yeah, it's like, I just thought of Steve Buscemi's character. I don't know why I'm thinking of all the movies today.
I don't know. You're movie boy.
I'm movie boy. in Billy Madison. Call up your friend or make sure that you're good with everybody in the world, because you never know when one of your friends is a serial killer and you want to be safe on his list.
So he's still keyed up, and he also realizes that there is one person in this world that's going to miss his mother, her best friend, Sally Hallett. So he calls her up. He invites her over for a surprise dinner with his mother. And when she arrives, the first thing she said was,
"Let's sit down. I'm dead."
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that.
He hits her with a brick, strangles her first with his hands, and then uses the same scarf that he had used to kill Aiko Koo.
And he did it with such force that he broke her neck. He later recalled, "I had broken her neck, and her head was just wobbling around with the bones of her neck just disconnected in the skin sac of her neck." So
Skin sacks of the neck.
Oh, man. So he placed Sally's body in his bed and spent his night in his mother's room.
Did he play beer pong with her butthole or anything like that? He's already got the dart game going with his mother's head.
Please, beer pong. He was playing it like a wine glass.
Oh, I see.
That is fun.
The next morning, he leaves in Hallett's car, but not without leaving a note for the police on his mother's bloody mattress. It read,
"Approximately 5:15 a.m. Saturday. No need for her to suffer anymore at the hands of this horrible, murderous butcher. It was quick, asleep, the way I wanted it. Not sloppy and incomplete, gents. Just a lack of time. I got things to do."
He's very busy, yeah.
"I got things to do." And that was 2 exclamation points after that.
Wow.
Yeah, it kind of sounds like a text message from you, Ben.
G2T.
Yeah. Got to.
Yeah. So Kemper drives for 3 days straight. He eventually reaches Colorado, and he's been popping bennies this entire time, popping trucker speed. He hallucinates most of the drive, and he said that he had the same feeling that he had after he killed his grandparents, this weird, surreal, out-of-body type of experience.
Right.
Yeah, he said,
"Wow, I've got to stop this before, because it is getting out of hand. I am not going to be responsible for what happens any further, and I don't like that idea."
No, definitely not.
So this is what I want to say. To me, with this shows again is, guys out there, when you're driving, wear a seatbelt, because you don't know.
Seatbelt?
60% of the guys on the road have just killed 8 women, their mother, mother's best friend. They're driving around on Benny, so be careful and buckle up.
And he was expecting a manhunt because he thought
that this was a part of a big fucking intricate game with the police.
Yeah, he thought that the police had been watching him, and as soon as he took off, the police were going to raid the house, find all the bodies, but nobody gave a fuck that Clarnell and Sally were dead.
Let's just face it. They sucked.
I mean, nobody seems to care about a lot of people here.
But on the other hand, most people who knew Clarnell, like, she was very popular at work.
No, she was very good at what she was good at her job. She had a distinct problem with men and with Eddie in general.
Yeah.
And I think it's because he was a co-ed butcher.
Yeah, that'll do it.
It's because he was a bit of a bastard.
Mm-hmm.
So 3 days went by. He heard no word on the radio of anyone finding the bodies. He stopped in Pueblo, Colorado, called up the Santa Cruz PD to confess to the killings. It took him several calls to convince him that he was serious.
They told him to call back.
Call back. Yeah. I just killed 8 women. Okay.
Yeah, I know. But the thing is, we're waiting. The buzzer's broken outside of the station. And we've ordered a couple of pizzas. We're having a bit of a pizza party. It's Marty's birthday. So if you could just wait, we need to keep these lines open.
Yeah. And he was so well-liked and so well-known by the police department, they thought that he was drunk. Like, it took him several calls because he knew these detectives by name. He knew who was on the case. Right. He's like, yeah, I need to talk to Detective Sturgill. And they called up Detective Sturgill. He's like, hey, listen, I got to tell you, I just killed my mother and her friend, and I'm also the co-ed killer.
And they were like, they're so used to him being a bumblebutt around the bar because he said that that was a carefully crafted persona that he had with them.
Yeah, it really was. He was just kind of a goof.
Right.
He was a police groupie, as they called him. And then he was just a harmless eccentric that was just, you know.
Pain in the ass. A guy who'd buy you a beer and he'd jaw your ear off and he'd fucking put bad songs on the jukebox.
Yeah.
And,
he's the guy that when you're out drinking, when he shows up and you're sober, you're like, ah, fuck, Kemper. Okay, I guess. And then after you have like five beers,
he's
your best
guy.
He's your best friend. Yeah.
Right.
So he said that he had gone all the way to Pueblo.
It was weird that one time we all got together that one night and he raped that head of lettuce.
Oh, yeah. That was funny, though.
It was kind of funny.
It was funny.
A good time.
We'd had a lot of Jaeger that night, so
you remember,
I just
Henry,
dismissed it.
Yeah, you remember. You ate it afterwards.
I had to.
Yeah.
We called it an Eddie salad.
Yeah, that was great.
Yeah, he said that he went all the way to Pueblo because he said he was afraid if he went straight to the local police department, they would shoot first and ask questions later, and he was, quote, terrified of violence.
Fucking pussy.
So, and I really do think that if Ed hadn't turned himself in and hadn't killed his mother, very likely he could have reached Bundy numbers.
But he killed his mom, it was all done.
Well, he was, as we said in the first episode, he was a displacement killer. He couldn't kill his mother, so he killed the next best thing, the women that his mother wouldn't let him meet.
But after he was caught, he said multiple times, if I was on the street, I'd kill again.
He went
out and said it, which everyone else is. That's where I would say he's the only honest thing he said.
Yeah.
Where all the other killers would be like, Dahmer found Christ and everyone knows stuff. Where it's just like, he knows.
He knows exactly what he is.
It's interesting. It's almost like a horror movie in the way that they found what, you know, he found what was cursing him this whole time, his mother. It's like when you find the bones and you have to put him in the sunlight at 5 a.m. to break the curse.
But there's a four-sequel contract that forces you to make more after you make the awesome ending of the first one.
Right.
So Kemper pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity, but three different court psychiatrists declared him to be sane. This is very interesting. Kemper, his diagnosis has been used since then as the standard for what legal insanity is, i.e. by reason of disease or defect, the defendant did not know what he was doing was wrong.
Yeah.
So that's still used to this day as far as the insanity defense goes. And when they asked him what he thought was a fitting punishment, he said, you know what, I've been thinking about this moment from childhood. He told the judge that he ought to be tortured to death. But the death penalty at the time was suspended nationwide, and he was sentenced to life in prison, spent a short stint in the California medical facility in Vacaville, California, and here he met up with his nemesis, his only competition, Herbert Mullen.
God, Herbert!
This would have been a fun time for him and the judge to play Gas Chamber.
Yeah.
His favorite childhood game.
That's true. Yeah, so he killed 13. He believed that he was trying to prevent an earthquake.
Yeah.
And Kemper said he was just a cold-blooded killer, killing everybody he saw for no good reason. All right? You're a no-class killer, I'd say.
Yeah.
That's what he yelled at her.
Yeah, he's like, you're not. And he would tease her. He would call him Herbie because Herbert hated it. Because
Herbert had a high habit of singing in a high-pitched, squeaky voice while people were watching TV.
Yeah.
He was just like, bunch of idiots watching the TV. What are you going to do? What are you going to do about it?
It's a real odd couple. I love it.
Oh, yeah. So finally, like, Kemper got sick of it, and he got into the habit of throwing water on like a cat, like you would a cat.
Right.
He would throw water on him, and then when he was a good boy, I'd give him peanuts. He said that was effective because pretty soon Herbie would actually ask permission to sing. This man like a cat.
What an annoying room of losers. That's the thing is you can see this context of just being like a group of just fucktards that are just the worst dudes to hang out with.
Yeah, there's one guy just saying like,
and you got a bumblebutt just going like, shut up, parrot. Yeah, it's a peanuts, parrot. Meanwhile, you're just a rapist trying to calmly watch some baseball.
Right.
And you're just sitting there, just guys.
Yeah. It's like grumpier old men or grumpy old men, but, you know, just some in prison.
Classy art thief who's forced to be dealing with it and just being like, where is it my tea? I remember when I stole the Mona Lisa from the Louvre, and now I'm here. Ah, oh, fate. Cruel, torturous fate.
Yeah, they're just so dumb. They're all so stupid.
Yeah, he said that it, quote, stuck in his craw that Kemper got 8 out of 8 counts of first-degree murder, while Mullen only got 2 out of 13 counts of first-degree murder.
But he followed up by saying, I guess it's kind of hilarious my sitting here so self-righteously talking like that. After what I've done.
Right, yeah, that is hilarious.
Yeah,
it is hilarious.
That's all part of Ed Kemper's thing. He believes himself to be special.
Yes.
He believes himself to be special.
His crimes are very personal.
Yes.
And he believes there's
reason.
Yes, and he believed that they had he is a man of reasons. Mm-hmm. And he believed that they had special connections. Him and the corpses had a special connection. I mean, it was all in loser talk because it was all like staring at the girl who comes into the 7-Eleven while you work at the cashier all day, just being like, I know we could be together. She just gave me a chance and I could show her all the delicious, spicy Dorito curls.
All right, just the bubblicious for you again today. Okay.
I love you, Becky.
Nope. There's more customers behind you.
Did I say it out loud, or was I just thinking it? I love you, babe. How are you? She won't give me a chance.
So while he was at Vacaville, he also participated in reading audiobooks for the blind.
He's got a very nice voice.
He does. He spent more than 5,000 hours in the booth in front of a microphone over 10 years. He has more than 4 million feet of tape and several hundred books to his credit.
So he's really one of the most successful voiceover people in California at the time.
Actually, he probably is. Yeah. Regular James Earl Jones.
Him and Mel Blanc. Yep.
Included in his work is a children's book called The Trumpet of the Swan, the fourth book of the Dune series, and a novelization of the Star Wars trilogy.
It's unbelievable they gave him... This is such a great job.
This is the perfect job.
I'm very jealous that he has this job.
This is what you want, technically, if you could read out loud.
Yeah.
That would be helpful.
So there is, we found the only thing we could find. We couldn't find any full recordings of his audiobooks. The only thing that we found listed, we did find an example on the volunteersofvacaville.org where they list a lot of the books that Edmund Kemper read. He read Flowers in the Attic. Now, I've never read Flowers in the Attic, but apparently, it is a horror novel, a very famous horror novel. I've never read it myself, but he read so many. Let's listen to
the melodious tunes.
The melodious tunes
of Eddie Kemper.
Of Eddie Kemper.
Chapter 1. Goodbye, Daddy. Truly, when I was very young, way back in the 50s, I believed all of life would be like one long and perfect summer day. After all, it did start out that way. There's not much I can say about our earliest childhood except that it was very good, and for that, I should be everlastingly grateful. We weren't rich, we weren't poor. If we lacked some necessity, I couldn't name it. If we had luxuries, I couldn't name those either, without comparing what we had to what others had, and nobody had more or less in our middle-class neighborhood. In other words, short and simple, we were just ordinary run-of-the-mill children.
Cool.
Chapter 1, paragraph 1. Flowers
Goodbye,
in the
Daddy. I love it. I love it. What a great little... He also wrote a series of short stories that I can't find. If anybody can find it, please send it to me. I've been digging and digging and digging. I can't find any of it, but he definitely wrote a bunch of short stories.
Yeah.
And I think most of them were called, like, Mommy's Blowing Me Again. You know what I mean? It's all just, like, stuff like that.
Yep. And if you can't find them, just write your own and just sign it at Kemper. Who knows?
We're not going to know the difference.
Who knows? Yeah.
So right now, he's still alive, and he's in Folsom State Prison. Here's a very interesting thing. Folsom also has an insurance agency called Kemper Preferred.
Interesting.
It's a real interesting thing. So Ed, of course, ever the talker, he has one of the most famous quotes in serial killer history. When he asked, "What do you think now when you see a pretty girl?" He said,
"One side of me says, wow, what an attractive chick. I'd like to talk to her, date her. The other side of me says, I wonder how her head would look on a stick."
Classic, though. Yeah, I mean, every time I look at a person.
Yeah, that's an absolute classic one. I mean, that's up there with, I ate her buttocks. I did not fuck her, though. She died a virgin. It's up there with that.
It's up there. Yeah, classic.
Up there with, serial killers are your fathers, your brothers, your husbands. We are everywhere.
Or everywhere you get every time you get everything right, and the tenth time you forget where the lug wrench is.
Yeah. It's up there. It's up there.
Guys... Yep. I just think it's interesting. I just think, it's like, fucking learn how to talk to people.
Well, I mean, you know how to talk to
people. Don't be a big fucking bumblebutt. But if you're ever described as a bumblebutt, seek to change it.
Yeah, I mean, unless it's really funny and people love you because of your bumblebutt.
Yeah. There's plenty of lovable bumblebutts out there.
We got three right here.
We're all a couple of bumblebutts.
Yeah. A trio of bumblebutts.
Uh-huh.
That's what we are. A confederacy of bumblebutts. How's that?
I love it. Kemper's still alive. He's got to be in his early 70s now.
Yeah.
His last interview was in 1991. He did it with this weird French guy. Really cool interview.
Yeah.
Crazy.
He is. I mean, I think now he's probably pushing 350.
Oh, he's a big. Yeah. He's a big one.
You don't eat very healthy in jail.
Yeah. All that power.
Yeah, he's gigantic. But yeah, that's Ed Kemper part two. Yeah, we really wrapped that one up, man. Ooh, Jesus Christ.
What a tale.
Yeah.
So again, don't hitchhike. If someone says put on the handcuffs, don't do it unless it's a really saucy BDSM situation
let
and
them
you guys are
kill
friends.
You. Yeah, let them kill you quick. Make them kill you quick.
Or fight back and don't die.
Yeah. Figure out a way.
Yeah.
Figure out a way. All right, everyone. Ooh, thank you so much
so
for
glad
listening.
I'm normal. That's one of those listening.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, always with the big hitters, the brains of these guys, I am not envious. No one's envious of them, but it is just, it's an awful existence for everybody.
Yes. It really is.
Hail Satan, thank you for your gifts. I've used magic this week and it has helped me.
Shout out to the person who gave you the drawing, Henry. An amazing Gacy drawing.
It's Brittany, that painting is amazing. It gave me true magic power. It is it's up in my bedroom right now, and it will scare whatever human ends up in there.
You made him lonely for another 3 months, but that painting's going to last a lifetime.
Yes.
So that's amazing.
And we've also got to give a shout out to
Lisa Willis
for a very generous donation. Thank you so much. That really, really, really helps us out a lot right now.
You're the best, Lisa. Yeah. You're the absolute best. Yes. Yeah. We'll see you soon.
And thank you so much for listening.
Thank you, Miss Lisa Willis.
And if you guys want to donate, if you donate $25 or more, you get a free Last Podcast on the Left t-shirt. Go to cavecomedyradio.com/Last Podcast on the Left to do that. $25 domestic, $40 international. Be sure to go to iTunes, rate and review. That's really helping us out a lot. Follow us on Twitter, LP on the Left. We've gained quite a few followers there right now. We're posting all kinds of great shit on there. Join the Facebook group and
live show
on, let's see here.
The 28th, I believe.
I believe it's the 28th. Yes, live show on Saturday, March 28th, here at the Creek in the Cave, 1093 Jackson Avenue in Long Island City, New York, off the G train, off the 7 train, off the E train. We're going to be starting at 10 p.m. It's going to be a fucking amazing live show this month. I'm very excited.
It's going to be a ripper and a dumper.
Both of those.
And Heil Geen, ladies and gentlemen.
Heil me! Now! Do it now!
Have I done a hail yourselves?
That's a good idea. And a magustalations to everyone.
Oh, yeah.
To every single one of you.
For more shows like the one you just listened to, go to cavecomedyradio.com.